Welcome to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129. If you want to listen to more of America This Week, subscribe to Sirius XM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. You're listening to America This Week with Father Matt Malone and Kerry Weber.
This is Tim Reedy sitting in for Kerry Weber, joined, of course, by Editor in Chief Father Matt Malone, and we're talking about the legacy of Justice Antonin Scalia, who just died this past Saturday. And we're talking with Professor Thomas Lee of Fordham University, who teaches Justice Scalia in his class. I wonder, Professor Lee, maybe you could talk, if we could pivot to talking about what his death now means for the court. Are we looking at a lot of 4-4 decisions, at least in the foreseeable future, and on what particular issues should we keep an eye out for?
So I'm gonna divide that into three parts. Golly est omnia divisa. But basically,
that's very Jesuitical of you.
So the first is the cases that he participated in that have not been issued, and if there are any 5-4s there, or any that he had a principal drafting role, then they're going to have to be rescrambled, right? And so the general rule is going to be that basically a 4-4 means that whatever the lower court decided will stand, and it's as if the Supreme Court didn't decide this. So the Chief Justice is going to have some management to do. So that's so we're in February, so the term opened 3 months ago, so they're going to have to figure that out for the cases that have been decided. Part two, until they get a new justice on there, and I think that's going to be very, not very, but probably not going to happen until at the very earliest next year's term. So the rest of the cases that will be argued or until the term ends in June, they're going to be 5-4. They're going to be 8 justice decisions, and so the ones that are divided that would have been divided 5-4 are now going to be 4-4. So that's going to make the former decision stand. And so there's a few big cases. The one involving the abortion clinic restrictions, that was the restrictions were upheld, and so that means that unless in all probability they'll be upheld again. Affirmative action, I don't remember the exact disposition of what happened in the lower court, but I think there the program was upheld, so that means it'll be upheld. The president's immigration power case, the president's power was questioned and struck down, so that means that will stand. So that's what's going to happen to the big cases in the intermediate term. So the ones that would have been 5-4 are now 4-4. And those seem to me the big ones that are out there. What's going to happen in the future? I mean, you know, it depends on this political impasse that's going on between the Republicans and the Democrats and with the presidential election. And so this 4-4 stalemate, there's a very good chance that it's going to extend, and we're not going to see a new appointment until the new president is sworn in January. That means that the next term, the one that begins in October of this year and goes until June of next year, may also be an 8-justice term. Now, the difference being that if the justices know that when they go to their conferences to pick new cases, knowing that it's going to be 4-4, that might change their approach to it. But that's the three parts. So there's the cases that were argued. Will be issued unless it was 4-4, unless he had the principal draft. If he had the principal draft, I think the chief will just send it to somebody else in the majority. So that's easily solved. The ones that are up for the rest of the term will probably be decided by 8 justices. And going forward, that pattern is going to continue until whoever's president, probably the next president, gets to put a replacement on there.
And, you know, given the polarization in the country, we could be in a situation after the presidential election where we have a president and a Senate, a White House and a Senate that are controlled by different parties. And you're quite right. I mean, this could extend on for quite some time, couldn't it?
Yeah. And I think that even if it ends up Democrat, Republican, Senate, then the stalemate will continue. I mean, obviously the time horizon shrinks for the Republicans because if they keep eight on that court for 2 or 3 years, I mean, that's going to look really bad from the perspective of the optics and public opinion. So I think that you know, they'll probably end it at some point,
right.
But it could continue for a while.
Now, you actually clerked for Justice Souter when he was an Associate Justice of the Court. Is that right?
I did.
And so I wonder if you could tell our listeners a little bit about what is it like inside the U.S. Supreme Court, and what roles specifically did Justice Scalia play in that in that dynamic?
Well, you know, it's a very rarefied world. I mean, there's 9 justices, and I clerked 15 years ago, and so that court, before Justice Sotomayor, Chief Justice Roberts, and Justice Kagan had been on, they had been together for a dozen years, and so they knew each other really well. They were on good terms, but it's a very isolated world. I mean, the justices each have their own chambers, and they each have 3 or 4 clerks and 2 secretaries of the police, and the chambers are physically very separated from each other, and the justices, they meet in conference, but they don't really lunch together or do much socially unless they're friends. And a lot of the communication is done among the clerks, right? So I think it's very important to be a good law clerk at the court that you have the right disposition and are a good negotiator and a diplomat. Justice Scalia happened to have the chambers next to us, and I was friendly with all of his clerks, so I got to know him pretty well. I mean, he really was larger than life and kind of a very charming, funny person. So, but it's a very rarefied, isolated
sure.
atmosphere.
Sure. You're listening to America This Week on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. We are talking with Professor Thomas Lee about the legacy of Associate Justice Antonin Scalia. We have a caller, John, from the Jersey Shore. You are on America This Week.
Hey, Father Malone, how are you?
Great.
Long time subscribed to America Magazine. Since
well, 84. Thank you very much.
Yeah, and been listening. Actually, listen to your podcast as well. And I'm an 88 graduate of Georgetown Law School. And I remember when Justice Scalia was appointed by Ronald Reagan, and this whole idea of originalism first came in, and I was in law school. And but the reason why I was calling is because I just heard the other night. Charlie Rose had David Bowles, who's a longtime litigator, many cases in front of the Supreme Court, on as a guest, and he was talking about this idea of originalism and what he was saying, and I'm kind of in accord with what he was saying, was that there was really only 2 originalists on the court, and it was Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas, and now that Justice Scalia is deceased, really it's down to Justice Thomas. And he also made a couple other points, like he said that the originalism, that even Justice Scalia had hard times dealing with originalism with respect to the changing society, like he used the example of the Internet and dealing with First Amendment rights. Obviously, there'd be no idea of originalism with respect to things that are more contemporary. And then the other thing he pointed out was that Justice Scalia was very acerbic in his opinion writing, frequently being very, very negative with some of the reasoning or what he perceived to be the reasoning of his fellow jurists, which limited his influence ultimately. And that was my take, too, because I remember reading some of these dissents that he used to issue when he was in the minority early on. And so that's what I was my comments were.
All right. Well, John, thanks so much. Professor Lee, what do you think?
Yeah, so I think that's I agree with 92% of that. I think that basically he and Justice Thomas are really the committed originalists. But you know, if you were here for my initial remarks, I said that basically he hasn't converted everybody, but certainly he has made everyone engage in it. And I think that Justice Alito, for example, seems to like the technique. And everybody, all the cases, it's taken much more seriously than it used to be. So it's a question of engagement. With regards to the point that Justice Scalia himself at some point understood that it wasn't the right way to be, I mean, that's right, too. I mean, the Internet is a good example. sort of a more jurisprudential doctrinal example is there's this idea of incorporation, and what that meant is the idea that the Bill of Rights, which were the first amendments ratified in 1791, that, and they were really about federal government power, but the idea which Justice Hugo Black had championed was the idea that, in fact, they apply to the states. Now, from an originalist perspective, that is probably about as wrong as you can prove something to be, but Justice Scalia accepted that. I mean, he said basically, we can't, you know, we've decided these cases, and it's become something that our jurisprudence depends on, and so I can't really justify unspooling that. And,
yeah.
And so he would call himself a faint-hearted originalist. Justice Thomas is different. I mean, he really does think that
he's hardcore, that, right?
Yeah. And then the final point about, and I can't remember about his rhetoric and
the acerbic nature of his.
I think that's right. I mean, he always had that about him, and Joan Biskupic wrote, who's a reporter for the Supreme Court on the USA Today, wrote a nice biography of him called An American Original, and on page 12 he talks about the fact that although he came from an Italian-American family, he was the only child not just of his parents but of his generation in that family. His parents had multiple siblings, but none of them had children, and I think somebody on the show had said that he had 28 grandkids. I think there's 36 by present count.
Holy Toledo.
And then numbers got up.
but you know, he did not play well with other children.
Right.
So there was that. And I think that as he got to be more curmudgeonly, the rhetoric sort of became more of what his opinions were about. And I think that was very unfortunate, because when it comes to a point where the rhetoric is almost more than the brilliance or the logic or the analytic rigor, then you just want to throw this thing away and not bother understanding what he's saying. And I think that was unfortunate, because when he was at his best, he really was special. It was just that basically that other part of him sort of consumed him when he really got into some of these opinions.
There was a way in which at times he became the caricature of himself.
Yeah.
Right? You know, it's interesting you point out, as our caller pointed out, that while there were two originalists on this court, Thomas and Scalia, they actually have different brands of originalism, don't they? I mean, Thomas really is an original intent person, and is not very sympathetic to stare decisis.
Yeah, so I wouldn't call him an original intent person. I think both of them agree about original public meanings.
Okay.
I think the problem is that if you've had a lot of intervening decisions that have come between the original meaning and where we are now, Scalia would say, you know, come on, we have to live in the now, and we have to adjust that. And I think that Justice Thomas would say, no, I don't care about all these intervening decisions. We have to go back to that original public meaning. And the gun case, McDonald versus Chicago, is a perfect example of the difference in opinion between the two of those. Because basically Justice Thomas wanted to recognize rights under a different part of the provision of the Constitution, the Privileges and Immunities Clause, and Justice Scalia essentially says, no, I mean, you know, I don't agree with incorporation and what's been happening with the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment, but I will accept it and participate in the analysis in that sense.
Now, Professor Lee, I know you've read Anton Scalia's writings extensively. So is, of course, my colleague, Father Matt Malone. But for those who don't know him and maybe are intrigued by him, he is somebody who's actually accessible to a general audience. You don't have to be a law scholar to read his work. He's very engaging. Is there one case or something maybe in closing that you could point to say this is a good place to start?
Yeah, that's a really hard question. maybe one of his And I only point in this direction because it's not what you would expect, but maybe one of his unreasonable search and seizure opinions about the plain view exception. One of those cases. I can't name a particular one. I think that one was called Hicks, but something like that. Because I think that people. Jurisdictional stuff is not very accessible, but is what the cops did to me unreasonable? It is, and he sort of really invigorated the idea that basically, if you know, a lot of these things, we wouldn't have allowed back in 1791.
So. Right. He wound up being kind of a surprising supporter of criminal defendant rights in many cases.
That's right. And I think the unreasonable search and seizure cases are the best example of that. I mean, he also, like, jury indictments and confrontation clause. But I think that's an area where he sort of is on the side of the angels. And so he kind of shows logic and arguments that you wouldn't have expected. There's also a case where he and Justice Stevens agreed upon. It was one of the Guantanamo Bay cases. I think it's called Hamdan. He wrote a concurrence, or was it a dissent? I don't remember. But basically, his point there is that if you're a U.S. citizen, Congress can't take away your right to file for a petition of habeas corpus. And that's an interesting opinion, because it's very rare that he and Justice Stevens were the only ones agreeing, and they actually agreed on that one.
And Justice Stevens, who was considered and is would consider himself a liberal.
Yeah.
Professor Thomas Lee, thank you very much for joining America This Week to talk about the legacy of Justice Scalia.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be on the show.
Okay. May he rest in peace.
Amen.
When we come back, we are going to be talking about the Holy Father's apostolic visit to Mexico and his trip later today to the U.S.-Mexico border. You're listening to America This Week on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Thank you for listening to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129. If you want to hear the full show every week, subscribe to Sirius XM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.